Translation. Elevated Mahatmas who have taken shelter at the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are fully satiated by the shade of those lotus feet. Their consciousness cannot possibly become attached to family members. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Srivanaratam Das Thakur has sung Nitai Pada Kamala Koshi Chandra Sushitala Ye Chayaya Jagat Judaya. He describes the shade of the lotus feet of Lord Nityananda as being so nice and cooling that all materialists who are always in the blazing fire of material activity, they come under the shade of His lotus feet and be fully relieved and satiated. The distinction between family life and spiritual life can be experienced by any person who has undergone the tribulations of living with the family. One who comes under the shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord never becomes attracted by the activities of family life. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 2:59, one gives up lower engagements when he experiences a higher taste. Thus one becomes detached from family life as soon as he comes under the shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord. Translation again. Elevated Mahatmas who have taken shelter of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are fully satiated by the shade of those lotus feet. Their consciousness cannot possibly become attached to family members. So here, Maharaj Parikshit more or less reiterates the same question that he has asked in the previous two verses. How can an elevated devotee become attached to material family life? Because the two do not go together. In the purport here, Srila Prabhupada encourages us who may already be in family life that if we want to be relieved of the blazing fire of material existence in the material world, we should take shelter of the lotus feet of Lord Nityananda, the lotus feet of the Lord. So, the previous version purport emphasized the fact that a devotee who's experiencing the higher taste of Krishna consciousness cannot become attached to the materialistic life or family attachment. And here the question in the verse is more or less the same. But in the purport, Srila Prabhupada starts from the other position of us, who are suffering in the material world, how we can get relief from the material pain by taking shelter under the shade of the lotus feet of the Lord, especially the all-merciful Lord, Nityananda. But it's more or less the same question that we discussed yesterday, and we'll proceed now to the next verse, text 4. Samshayo yamaha brahman tadakara sitadishu saptasya yat siddhir abhut krishne chama tirachuta. The king continued, O great Brahman, this is my great doubt. How is it possible for a person like King Priyavrata, who is so attached to wife, children, and home, to achieve the topmost infallible perfection in Krishna consciousness? Purport by Srila Prabhupada. King Parikshit wondered how a person so attached to wife, children, and home could become so perfectly Krishna conscious. Prahlad Maharaj had said, Atirna Krishna Parata Svatova Mito Vipajeta Graha Vritanam. A Griha Vrata, one who has taken a vow to execute family duty, has no chance to become Krishna conscious. This is because most Griha Vratas are guided by sense gratification, and therefore gradually glide down to the darkest regions of material existence. Adanta Govir Vishatam Tamishram. How can they possibly become perfect in Krishna consciousness? Maharaj Parikshit asked Shukadeva Goswami to resolve this gross doubt. So here the question is posed from the other side, because King Parikshit had heard that Maharaj Shivrata was a great devotee, but then he had become involved in family life. Then again he had heard that in the end Priyavrata had become a great devotee. So the first question was, how can someone who's a great devotee become involved with family life? And the question here is, how can someone who's entangled in family life become a great devotee? So both situations are difficult to reconcile, because being a great devotee doesn't mix with material attachment. And therefore, for a great devotee to become involved in family life doesn't fit. And then again, for someone entangled in family life to become a great devotee also doesn't fit. So Maharaj Parikshit was asking the same question from both sides. And here the question is, how can someone who's attached to family life become a great devotee? And the answer is, they can't. And the reference here is from Prahlad Maharaj's discussion with his father, which I happened to quote on Tuesday in connection with Sri Rama Ekadasi and the concluding words from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Matirna Krishne Parato Svato Va. Hiranyakasipu had asked his son Prahlad what was the best thing that he had learned in school. Gospels. Hiranya Kasipu was a great materialist, and he had arranged for a materialistic education for Prahlad. So Prahlad was just a young boy of 5 years, and his father was naturally affectionate to him, and he thought this little child would give some cute answer, like he'd like to ask children questions so he can hear their answers. He also asked, what subjects do you like in school? So he asked, what is the best thing you learn in school? And Prahlad replied, the best thing he learned was to become Krishna conscious. Mm-hmm. Now that really upset Hiranyakasipu, to say the least. Hiranyakasipu became furious. The first time he heard the answer, he called the two teachers and accused them of being responsible for Prahlad's mind becoming polluted with devotion to Vishnu, who Hiranyakasipu considered to be his enemy, because Vishnu, in the form of Varaha, had killed Hiranyakasipu's brother, Hiranyaksha. But the teacher said that you are wrongly accusing us. We have not taught him Krishna consciousness, nor have we allowed devotees in disguise to infiltrate the campus. You should not accuse us. So then Hiranyakasipu said, well, then how did he become Krishna conscious? And the teacher said, well, you should ask him. We don't know. He seems to be naturally Krishna conscious. So then Hiranyakasipu asked Prahlad, and Prahlad replied with these very beautiful verses, one of which begins with the two lines that Srila Prabhupada quoted in the purport, Matirna Krishne, Matir means inclination. Inclination towards Krishna or Krishna consciousness cannot arise by paratha, by the efforts of others, foretold by one's own efforts, or by the combined efforts of oneself and others. Especially for grihavritas, people have vowed that their goal in life is to maintain their family members and enjoy family life. So when Prahlad answered his father that, you know, you cannot become Krishna conscious by your own efforts or by the efforts of others or by the combined efforts of yourself with others, it again seemed like a paradox. It was another great mystery, because it seemed logically that all the possible ways that one can become Krishna conscious have been rejected. And then Prahlad recites the verse, Mahapada Bisho Vishetam, that one can become Krishna conscious only when one accepts the dust of the lotus feet of the pure devotee, his Kinshananam, who is completely free from material attachment. And that, not to give away the story, but that precisely is the same answer that resolves the mysterious situation here, that how could someone who is entangled in family life become such a great devotee? And as we will read later, it was by the same process of taking shelter of the spiritual master. And Priyavrata's spiritual master was the same as Prahlad, Arjuna. And that is the process by which an entangled householder or an ordinary person, born in a materialistic family, can be delivered. And almost every one of us sitting here has had the same experience. That we began as ordinary people. We have the same attachments as ordinary people, engaged in the same sinful activities as ordinary people. So how did we come to this position? By the mercy of Srila Prabhupada. By the mercy of the servants of Srila Prabhupada. Otherwise there's no other explanation. I mean, we read in Bhagavad Gita that those who have acted piously in the present life and in past life, and who are completely freed from sinful actions and reactions, they can take to devotional service. But if we look at our lives, more or less, none of us can say that we acted piously and that we were freed from sinful actions and reactions. Then how could we come to Krishna consciousness? It's by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada and his service. It's the only explanation. Sometimes we read in the scriptures that fortunate souls come to Krishna consciousness. But again, if we look at our lives, in most cases, our lives before we came to Krishna consciousness were not very fortunate. So how could we come to Krishna consciousness? And in reply to that question, Srila Prabhupada said, I have created your good fortune. We didn't have the assets and pious activities before. We didn't have the freedom from sinful activities before. But the mercy of Srila Prabhupada created a situation by which we immediately became pious, just by his association and service. We immediately became free from sinful reactions by the chanting of the holy names of the Lord, and we were able to engage in devotional service. Therefore, we're sitting here today. So this is the basic question. How could it be? How could the two go together in the same person? And now, we will begin the answer. A very, very important verse and purport. Text 5. It's a prose verse, so I'll read the anyway, it's a prose text. Sri Shuka Uvacha. Badham uktam bhagavata uttama shlokasya srimat charanaravinda makaranda rasa avisheta chetaso bhagavata paramahansa daita katam kinchit antaraya vihatam svam shivatmam padavim nakayena indati. Translation. Sri Shukadeva Goswami said, what you have said is correct. the glory of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is praised in eloquent transcendental verses by such exalted personalities as Brahma, are very pleasing to great devotees and liberated persons. One who is attached to the nectarian honey of the Lord's lotus feet and whose mind is always absorbed in his glory may sometimes be checked by some impediment, but he still never gives up the exalted position he has acquired. So this is a very relevant question, because we see that devotees who were apparently advanced in Krishna consciousness sometimes stumble along the way, and sometimes they appear to fall on the path. So how is it possible? This is the essence of the question. An important question for all of us, because even if we don't stumble or fall in an obvious way or in a gross way, we all experience within our struggles to advance in Krishna consciousness that sometimes we seem to be doing better and other times not so well. And in subtle ways, we're always sort of falling down and picking ourselves up. So, why? Why do we fall down sometimes? And what's actually happening there? How do we pick ourselves up? Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sri Shukadeva Goswami accepted both the king's proposition that a person who advanced in Krishna consciousness cannot embrace materialistic life again, and that one who has embraced materialistic life cannot take up Krishna consciousness at any stage of his existence. Although accepting both these statements, Shukadeva Goswami qualified them by saying that a person who has once absorbed his mind in the glories of the Supreme Personality of Godhead may sometimes be influenced by impediments, but he still does not give up his exalted devotional position. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, there are two kinds of impediments to devotional service. The first is an offense at the lotus feet of a Vaishnava. This is called Vaishnava Aparad. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu warned his devotees not to commit Vaishnava Aparad, which he described as the mad elephant offense. When a mad elephant enters a beautiful garden, it destroys everything, leaving a barren field. Similarly, the power of Vaishnava aparad is so great that even an advanced devotee becomes almost devoid of the spiritual assets if he commits it. Since Krishna consciousness is eternal, it cannot be destroyed altogether, but advancement may be checked for the time being. Thus, Vaishnava aparad is one kind of impediment to devotional service. So, it is a long purport, and I suppose I'll have to postpone my departure for Houston for a few hours, so that we can continue the discussion tomorrow. So Vaishnava aparad, there are so many verses in the scriptures about the horrible effects of Vaishnava aparad.
There's the case of King Bharat, who also was very advanced in devotional services, and that he had attained the stage of Bhava-bhakti, which is the liberated state. But still, he became attached to a deer. And at the time of death, he thought of the deer. And in the next life, he took birth as a deer. But although he took birth in the body of a deer, he retained the consciousness of a human being, and not just an ordinary human being. He retained the consciousness of his previous life. So he could consider what had happened in the past and what to do in the future. And so even in the body of a deer, he would seek out the sages and listen to their talks of Krishna. And then in the next life, he took birth as Jadbhara. And although he was, you know, a highly exalted Paramahansa, he was so afraid of becoming entangled and attached again that he pretended to be a dumb brute. And he just remained aloof from any possible allurements into material attachment again. So it's a long story, but eventually, because he was physically strong, he was taken as a palanquin bearer for the king. But he was so exalted in Krishna consciousness that while carrying the palanquin, he wouldn't step on an ant. So he was always looking to see if there were any insects. And consequently, he was sort of stepping this way and that way to avoid killing any innocent creatures. And meanwhile, the king was being jostled in the palanquin, and he became angry. So he told the palanquin bear, stop. He got out and started to chastise Jadbhara. And Jadbhara, being a liberated soul, was not affected by the insults and abuses. And later on, he sort of turned around everything that the king had said and made it all true from a spiritual point of view, like the king in a sarcastic way, because he was built very strong, Jadbhara. So the king in a sarcastic way said, oh, you see, you appear to be very lean and thin, and that's why you can't carry the palanquin properly. So later he said, yes, that's true, because I'm just a spirit soul. I'm 1/10,000th the size of the tip of a hair. So that's true. And he wasn't disturbed at all by any of the insults. And, you know, and anyway, eventually he uttered a very powerful statement that he's not afraid of anything. But Bharat said, I am not afraid of the thunderbolt of King Indra. I'm not afraid of the trident of Lord Shiva. I'm not afraid of them. There's only one thing I'm afraid of, and that is Vaishnavapura. So Vaishnavapura is the greatest danger on the path of devotional service. And the scriptures are full of warnings about Vaishnavapura. I just gave one example. Now, we're living in a society of devotees, and we have a mission to spread Krishna consciousness, what Srila Prabhupada and Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Now, what if we see that a devotee is doing something wrong? Do we try to correct the devotee, or do we remain silent? If we remain silent, are we being negligent in our duty to our spiritual master's mission? And if we try to correct the devotee, are we going to commit a Vaishnava apparat and wreak havoc in our spiritual life? What do we do in a practical way? In fact, it's humorous that Srila Prabhupada in Juhu, he was like training us to be attentive and vigilant. And on one morning walk, he said in a sarcastic way, you know, don't be Jagbara, that you don't see anything, you don't hear anything, you don't speak anything, you don't do anything. I want you to see if something's wrong, and I want you to correct it. Well, that's easy enough if we notice that the tap is running and we turn it off, or if we notice that the lights have been left on and we turn them off. You know, yeah, we can be attentive like that. We can, you know, we can be attentive that, you know, the chokidar does ring the bell on time. But what about if we see a fellow devotee doing something wrong? Then what do we do? So this is the question that we all face, especially devotees in positions of authority. And here I would say that the crucial consideration is the attitude of the devotee who is attempting to correct the other devotee. Especially when we're in positions of authority, and I don't refer only to the authority in the structure of this kind, but we all have positions of authority. If we're a teacher, we're in a position of authority. If we're a husband, we're in a position of authority. If we're a parent, we're in a position of authority. And it's our duty to properly educate and train and correct our dependents. So how do we do that without committing an offense? Because our students may be devotees, our wife may be a devotee, our child may be a devotee. And we don't want to offend them either. So, it's more a matter of one's consciousness when one attempts to make the correction than the fact of attempting to make the correction. Just to make it very vivid and practical. If we can correct with sympathy or with love, or we can, you know, correct with hatred. And even with ulterior motives. Holiness Ramakrishna Goswami once commented in relation to the controversy that developed around the Radha Damodar party, where the temple presidents, who were mainly householders, were disturbed because they felt that the Radha Damodar party was coming to the temples and encouraging the brahmacharis to leave the temples and join the party, and that the temples were being disturbed. And as, you know, the different reports were presented to Srila Prabhupada, and as Srila Prabhupada assessed the situation, it did appear that the temple presidents were disturbed, many of them, and that the preaching may not have been completely correct to say, although there was a lot of truth to it, I must say. And I know Tamal Krishna Goswami commented to me that he really felt that the Radha Damodara Party had saved the Brahmachari Ashram in the United States. So, I mean, you know, certainly tremendous good came out of the Radha Damodara Party. And so much money came to India. I mean, the Juhu project, the main projects that were all supported by the collections from Radha Damodara. So it was a great service. But still, somewhere there was something that was creating a disturbance. And later, Tamal Krishna Goswami commented to me that he felt that although some of the temple presidents may have been right in their criticism or complaint, but many of them fell down later because their attitude was wrong. Even though their points may have been right, but their attitude was wrong, and therefore they fell down. I think that is the crucial point. We all need to be corrected. You know, we do, we're human, we tend to make mistakes. We may not be able to see our mistakes, but our friends might, our authority. And if we trust our friend, I mean, if he's really a friend, of course we would trust our friend, then we'll hear what he has to say or what she has to say, and we won't feel threatened, and we won't just dismiss it. But if we think, you know, is this person my friend? You know, why is this person saying this? Then we may not take the criticism, even if the criticism has some validity. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada said that criticism offered with sympathy is more likely to be accepted. So I think that's the real question. Is there, in the criticism or the correction, is there malice? Is there hatred? Are there political agendas involved? Or is there love? Is there sympathy? You know, is there genuine respect and good wishes? And that makes all the difference. That distinguishes a correction, a true correction from an offense. Now, I didn't mention anger. And anger, sometimes Srila Prabhupada would become angry with us if we made a mistake. But even anger can be with love, or it can be with hatred. Usually in the material world, anger comes with hatred. But with devotees, especially, you know, exalted devotees like Srila Prabhupada, other exalted servants of Srila Prabhupada, the anger can come with love. Prabhupada would become angry with us if we made a mistake, and his anger served a purpose. It helped remove the ignorance or whatever the problem was that we had that caused us to make a mistake. But we knew that Srila Prabhupada loved us. So even anger can be used in the service of the Lord, and anger can be used in the process of correction if it's with love. But if it's with hatred, I mean, even if it's with love, it can be quite hard to digest. But if it is with love, we're ready to digest it. But if it's with hatred, I don't want this. You know, I don't even know if he's maybe what he's saying is true, but I don't want this. I don't want to be with this person. was this person telling me what to do with my life and my service? So, and even then there's different categories. Correcting a subordinate or a junior, correcting an equal. Sometimes we're even in a situation where you sort of have to correct a superior. And there are different subtle points of etiquette that one should observe. Of course, in every case, internally, we should feel humble. We should respect the person that we're trying to correct as a devotee. And we ourselves should feel humble in our own position. And pray, you know, to pray to Krishna, pray to Guru, to give us the right words, to put us in the right consciousness, to give us the right words, to point out what we feel we have to point out. And with the superior in general, one will question. One will ask a question. One won't say that this is wrong and you did something wrong, but one will question. Like sometimes Srila Prabhupada's god brothers, not all of them, but some of them on some occasion acted in ways that Srila Prabhupada considered were inappropriate. And they were inappropriate. And sometimes his god brothers criticized him, which also was inappropriate. I mean, first of all, the criticism itself may not have been justified. In fact, was not justified. And then again, to criticize him to his disciples was even worse. And some of them seemed to want to actually get Prabhupada's disciples to leave Prabhupada and come to them. So this is just to illustrate the point that you don't directly criticize a superior, but you can question them. So one of these god brothers had been sent to England by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and then called back to India. And he was very critical of Srila Prabhupada in different ways. So Prabhupada's disciples would hear the criticism, which I would dare say, maybe I shouldn't dare. Anyway, they would hear the criticism and tell Srila Prabhupada, and then Srila Prabhupada would say, you go back and you ask him, you know, what did you do when you were in England? You know, why did Guru Maharaj call you back to India? Like that question. And even if it's like a more normal situation. You know, we can question, you know. I'm just making this up as an example, but, you know, do you think it's really a good idea for the temple to be involved in smuggling? You know, something like that. Do you think it's really a good idea to, like, steal computers from the Supreme Court judge and try to sell it on the, you know. So question, when you deal with a superior, you question. And if that doesn't work, of course we can, within the structure of ISKCON there's always grades of authority, so there are always levels of appeal. Some people think that something's seriously wrong, and we can't solve the problem directly. You know, we can appeal to higher authorities to intervene. So we come to the CBC body, and then after that, it's Prabhupada and Krishna. So, anyway, in, you know, we're meant to be a family, and we are. We actually are a family. And in, you know, in that, I think whatever it is, we should always have the feeling that we're family. You know, this is my family, and I have nowhere else to go. And whoever I'm dealing with, they're also part of the family. They also can't go anywhere. So whatever it is, we're family, and we have to deal with each other with care and respect and love. And we should know that, you know, we've given up everything to come to Srila Prabhupada's family. And we're not going to leave the family, and we don't want anyone to leave the family. We want others to come into the family, so we definitely don't want anyone to leave the family. And whatever it is, we should tolerate. You know, maybe someone made a mistake, maybe we can't correct them, depending on how serious the mistake is. Maybe we should just tolerate. Or some authority has abused me, tried to correct me in an inappropriate way, you know, spoken harshly to me or embarrassed me in front of others, which he shouldn't have done, properly speaking. And we can talk about it and try to work it out, but ultimately we have to tolerate, because the family we'll always have in this world, and we have to cherish each other and love each other and keep each other close. Hare Krishna. So, tomorrow we'll discuss the other category of impediment. Today the category was Vaishnava Aparat, but there's another category. And we'll also try to discuss how one overcomes those impediments and becomes reinstated in one's position. So are there any questions or comments? I don't call on you first. Finished. All right, well, there's Rati Kendra, there's Sri Radhika, there's Bhakti Rab. Okay, did you give that? Of how advanced he was in Krishna consciousness. But a deer, anyway, it's a whole story, but anyway, he decided to give shelter to a small deer that had lost its mother. And he just became more and more absorbed in thoughts of the deer, to the point that he was always thinking of the deer. Even when he was engaged in his worship, within his mind, he was thinking of the deer. And thus, he fell down. Now, in a subtle way, he fell down. Now, this is a big topic. How could such an advanced devotee fall down? How could such an advanced devotee become so attached to an insignificant deer? Now, one proposition could be that Bharat Maharaj had committed an offense in his past life, and so he was affected in his present life. Or another answer, sort of similar, could be that he was suffering a karmic reaction. Now, different acharyas have different ways of seeing things and presenting things. And Srila Prabhupada's purport, he emphasizes 2 points. One, the misuse of independence, which is a major theme in Srila Prabhupada, the misuse of independence. And the other point he makes, which is related, is that Bharat Maharaj decided, you know, to extend himself to the deer and to become increasingly involved with the deer without consulting the spiritual master, without consulting the deer. So Srila Prabhupada's conclusion or warning to us is that we should not act independently. You know, we should consult and have our actions approved. And on the other, on the most basic level, is that we have free will. We have unlimited independence, we have free will, and in any position, we can use it properly or misuse it. And therefore, even the verse, even though the verse suggests that it was because of Bharat Maharaj's karma that he became attached to the deer and fell down, in the purport, Srila Prabhupada says that, and I'm sure Srila Prabhupada is also following the previous acharyas, that we cannot just accept that it was his karma. We have to hold him responsible because he misused his independence. Oh, if I can interrupt you, this is also an important point about just coming to the question of how devotees fall down, why devotees fall down. Because what Prabhupada said about Bharat Maharaj not consulting, it reminded me, because this subject has come up, obviously, in our lives as devotees. And I remember when, and I'm going a bit straight here, but when one of our godbrothers, who was initiating, fell down, was the first one actually to fall down after a few years after the reform. So we were all thinking, oh, now we fixed it, we fixed the problem, it won't happen again. So when I heard that he had, you know, left, written a letter and left the movement, I was like really upset. So I was in Bombay and I phoned the colleague of Radhanathswami, you know, just to see if he heard the news and if it was true. And so then the colleague of Sridharswami and I drove down and we met Radhanathswami and we all talked. And Radhanathswami's initial reaction was he didn't have friends. And he felt that that was one of the main problems with some of our godbrothers in the positions they were in, that they didn't have friends. They sort of isolated themselves, or they, you know, sort of kept with their disciples, but they didn't have friends that they could open their hearts to and know if necessary get advice from. And then it came up again, and I'm not even sure if there wasn't really a discussion on the topic, but the last time when Holiness Kamal Krishna Goswami visited me in Santa Barbara, he himself has brought up the question, you know, how is it that some of our godbrothers, even those who had performed devotional service for years, you know, have chanted for years, who read the books for years, and done great service to the movement, fell down, or to put it another way, what to do not to fall down. And he said two things. One is the association of God brothers. The same point that Radhakrishnan made, the association of God brothers. And the second point that he mentioned was taste for the holy name. Taste for the practices of Krishna consciousness in general, and specifically taste for the holy name. Taste for the topics of Krishna consciousness. I guess I thought of that because Prabhupada's point in the purport that he shouldn't have just done his own deposit to, you know, extend himself to the deal, he should have consulted before.
Yeah. It's amazing to talk about.
Oh, wait, sorry to interrupt you again. Now, on this point of taste, just coming back to the point of taste. Now, okay, well, I don't have taste, what do I do? So there's two answers. One is that we just do service, you know. Dhyan Mahat, they veil Vipra by serving the pure devotees who are freed from vice, one develops taste with the messages of Vasudeva Katarachi. The other is that one may have taste, but if one commits offenses, this taste wanes. So again, we're back to the issue of offenses. But if we, as a matter of duty, chant our rounds, hear the classes, read the books, join the kirtan, and, you know, keep busy in devotional service and don't commit offenses, will develop taste, and then that will make us more secure.
Mark, two things I want to raise is the feeling that the association of devotees from our family. But for Grihastha, at least for me, very difficult to extend the same affection, care, and love I would extend to my immediate family than to the greater body of devotees. Like, say, an example, if I have a child, I can buy a gift of, say, $100 for the birthday, but when my neighbor's birthday, the child has a birthday, I might buy a $5 gift. So I want a $1 gift for the child. So being grasses, we get caught up in our personal interests. Being a sannyasi might be different, but there might be some of the subtle issues being a sannyasi. But for a grasses, the things are very obvious and very gross. How do I extend this feeling of love and family to the greater body of the body? And how we can facilitate that? And if some devotee deals with us in a certain way, which kind of violates the peace at home or the sanctity, sanity in your house, some devotees interfering in some matter, how you deal with it, to at the same time seeing that this is my brother, my sister, who's doing this in the house. So it's quite an awkward situation, I feel, for a grihastha living in a devotional community.
Well, there's immediate family and extended family. It's natural to have more affection for your immediate family, to be more concerned about your immediate family. That's natural. But one can still have affection and care for the extended family. What we should avoid is the mentality of friends and enemies. That we should avoid. But otherwise, that's natural. I mean, no one will find fault with you if you spend more money on your child's birthday than on your neighbor's birthday. But if you have that, but still, if you see them as extended family and at least wish them well on their birthday with a small gift, they won't feel bad. No, they will find fault for you for spending more on your own child's birthday present. Now, as far as living in a community where you feel the community members interfere with your family life, well, that's a problem. But it's not in principle any different from any other problem that can arise between devotees. And that is, we have to try to work it out. I mean, of course, we have so much energy and so much time, and, you know, we can't devote our full energy and time to kind of mend the relations with the neighbors. But, you know, we could have maybe like some association of householders where we discuss these problems. I mean, this is just an example. Chanakya Pandit says that, you know, that one should never come between a husband and a wife. That one who comes between a husband and a wife becomes an enemy to both. So, I mean, there may be certain principles of etiquette, there may be certain guidelines that the community of householders can establish just based on, you know, the little scriptures and even sort of conventional wisdom. But, you know, and then there's a, but what you say is true, that a householder, because of his natural partiality to his family members, faces certain complexities. And therefore, Queen Kunti prays to Lord Krishna to sever her ties for her two families. The Vrishnis and the Pandavas. And in the purport, Srila Prabhupada mentions that both of her families were devotees, and therefore affection for devotees and service to devotees is not outside the range of devotional service. But there was a material side to the relationship. So what she was praying was that the material side of the attachment should be purified and the spiritual dimension of the attachment should remain. And then Srila Prabhupada mentioned the same point, that because of being attached to the two families, she was expected to be partial to her family. But the one family was in Delhi, or Hastinapur, and they wanted Krishna to stay there. And the other family was in Dwarka, and they wanted Krishna to come back. So she felt she was caught in between. And because she was part of their family, she was supposed to be partial. You know, it's like sometimes the wife, like if there's an argument, anyway, it's like the wife will feel it's the husband's duty to take the side of the wife. You know, it's his duty to be partial. So there are those complexities, and they just do come with Krishna Dasha. But still, you know, we should not get involved in the mentality of friends and enemies. We have our immediate family and our extended family. And if, yes, we might give support to our immediate family if there's some conflict with the extended family. But we should, as far as possible, try to work things out so that, you know, there's peace in the family. Let's take today's question.
You mentioned that you're in tolerance while reading the problem on the side of the conflict with the community of humans before the humans. And you mentioned that it has to be. We can do that if we think that our family and our family will see it. So is this that people get better or they can improve if you as an individual keep having that feeling, or does it have to be from both sides?
Oh, well, that's a good question. Yes, certainly the relations among the devotees will improve if all the devotees feel that they're just part of the same family. But will they also improve if you feel that you're, you know, if you see them as part of the family but they don't see you as part of the family? It will help. It will help.
How come you feel part of the family?
Yeah, because sometimes family members, you mean, if you see the other person as part of the family. Yeah, because sometimes family members go through difficult periods. And it's their family, I mean, they might be temporarily overcome, like teenagers, you know, sometimes teenagers, they get overcome with, or even children, adults, they become overcome, like, you know, they just forget who they are, they forget who you are. You know, Prabhupada sometimes gave the example that, you know, the psychiatrist is trying to help the patient, but sometimes the patient turns against the psychiatrist, you know, thinks the psychiatrist is an enemy, wants to attack the psychiatrist, but the psychiatrist knows that it's just a patient who's having a mental disturbance. So, even if someone has a mental disturbance and consequently is not treating us as if we were their friend or their brother or sister, but we still know that the person is our family member, but it's just, you know, having a mental disturbance. And if we're, you know, kind and patient, eventually, you know, the mental disturbance will subside and the person will come to his senses or her senses and realize, oh, how could I have, you know, thought like that, or how could I have done that? You know, we're all family, they're all my well-wishers, they're not my enemies.
Thank you.
Maybe we should discuss this later. Somehow I'm stumped by this question right now.
I don't know if I did quite right. They all fall away mentally, sir.
Is that what you're hoping?
No, we
shouldn't hope that they fall away. We should hope that they rectify themselves.
So if they make a turnaround and admit their fault and, beg for forgiveness or whatever, then they're rectified.
Yes. That's the process with Vaishnavapura.
Well,
you recognize the offense you committed, and you pray to the person that you've offended to forgive you. And Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur goes even further. Let's say, instead of blaspheming a devotee, it's better to glorify a devotee. That's the most positive way to respond to the offense of Sadhu Vinda.
Perhaps if you could go to that person about the superior and ask the question, why did you say this, or, it's rare, but it has happened many times in my experience. The person always calls down, horribly most of the time.
Well, I think that if they haven't fallen down enough yet, you would think they must have some sincerity to them. Otherwise, Krishna would have kicked them out already. And, maybe sort of moderate your indignation with the recognition that, they must have some sincerity because they're still around, they're still chanting, they're still associating with devotees, they're still serving. So maybe they've already made the adjustment internally and we don't even know it. That's a good question. It just as householders, may need to get together and discuss their difficulties and their strategy. The same could apply to teachers in Krishna consciousness. I would say that there are, this is probably always true, but there are devotees who are serving the spiritual masters or sannyasis or spiritual leaders of this kind. And they have friends that they discuss with. I think that was one of the strongest points of Tamal Krishna Goswami. He would always discuss with his bad brothers. And he would always, whenever there was a major decision, he would take their advice. And sometimes he would, make a great effort to assemble a group of God brothers to discuss the situation with, to get their advice. And then there are God brothers who are naturally close to certain other God brothers, and they meet and they discuss very openly. They help each other that way. But I think that to sort of institute a
beneficial for them. I mean, it could help to some extent, especially if someone is sort of isolated. And, you know, it could help to have like an official time or place or program for them to get together and discuss. But if, I can say that where there is that sort of natural affinity among God brothers on that level, and they get together and talk, it's very congenial and helpful.
What I'm seeing is that we are an organization. So many times people like to see that, you know, this is just an organization that does what it is well.
Yeah. Well, these, you know, this is a big question, saying that we're an organization, and people like to see that in an organization that things are done in a consistent way. And that's true. And I think in some areas that, you know, it can be made more consistent than in other areas. Like, you know, the deity worship, the daily schedule, even like with a chain of restaurants, to have a certain standard. But at the same time, there's also individuality. And Srila Prabhupada, you know, everything is a matter of balance. You know, Srila Prabhupada didn't want bureaucracy. He wanted individual initiative. But at the same time, we don't want sort of these wild individualists who just, you know, they're like mavericks. They go out and shoot up the town. They know no law and they know no authority. You know, we don't want that either. And therefore, Prabhupada said that we need to discuss. He even said that UBC should come to discuss, together to discuss how to achieve unity and diversity. Because if it's just unity without diversity, it's like being impersonalist. But it's not that we're on the same frequency. And if there's diversity with no unity, then it's like the materialists. They're always fighting with each other. But somehow we have to discover the trick of how to achieve unity and diversity. And, but it's true that people like consistency. You know, any organization has to be truly successful, it has to have a certain standard. And people have to feel confident with the organization that it will keep to a certain standard. And I know the GDC or the North American GDC is working on some standards and creating a legal setup whereby which a temple to be legally considered an ISKCON affiliate has to be of a certain standard in different areas. And if they're not up to the standard, they can lose their affiliation. So there's an important question that we have to deal with. Would you like to say more?
Because I would say, just like that, there are some senior members who have vast experience and wisdom, which if it's not disseminated and shared, and it does not filter down to all levels. So, even in a similar, you know, situation where people are working.
That's true. I mean, most societies, most cultures have elders. And even if the elders don't have like official positions in the management, but they're the elders, and the elders consult them. some devotees have commented that a lot of our elders are sort of estranged or alienated or marginalized. We should have more of a culture of respecting the elders and taking advice from the elders. And I think if the culture was there, then, you know, that mood was there, then the elders would naturally want to share their knowledge. I imagine that they're reluctant more because they're not sure how their advice would be received, and because they just want to keep it all to themselves. So there could be people who have knowledge and they're just not used to sharing it anymore. But even they, if they're approached to share it, I'm sure they'd be happy to share it. I don't know, I'm really catching you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, I know many, even Tamal Krishna goes around. I mean, there's so many. There's so many senior devotees who, and there's going to be more and more because of our age, our, and physical condition will be less involved like we were traveling, preaching, managing, but we'll have all the more knowledge and experience and realization than when we were doing those things. And it's, you know, if we have that culture of respecting elders and taking advice from elders, it would really be good for everyone. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.